We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Do you really understand what this country is all about?
I hear all kinds of misconceptions and misstatements.
Light this motherfucker up!
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The idea of patriotism assumes that the government and the citizens have the same interest.
Peace is a beautiful but shitty idea.
The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America.
Yes, sir. Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Well, this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction.
By any means necessary.
Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph.
What's up, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See, here on another Friday morning in America. And here, hit this. Take a walk with me for a minute. I want to talk to you. So, we've discussed a lot about aberrant forms of Christianity, not just in the last couple of episodes, but this season, and really throughout the course of the show. And I think that as a person who talks to a relatively large group of people several times a week for several hours, you know, it's something that I think is important that gets lost in the shuffle amongst people who do what I do, or versions of what I do anyway, is fucking nuance. You know, I've discussed in the past on the show that I went to a fundamentalist Christian missionary alliance school for several years until I got kicked out. I also ended up graduating from that school because there was a whole thing with homeschool credits and transferring. So I spent several years kind of immersed within fundamentalist Christian, you know, missionary-based evangelical white Christianity as an adolescent. I was also in a legal foster care and adoption situation with a lot of white people who harbored very traditional, conservative, white American Christian values. So I grew up in and out of environments inundated with the kind of stuff I'm talking about. And as such, as a younger person, I was very, very angry about religion. Very, very angry at the idea of a God because, you know, as a young person who doesn't believe in God, you're very, very angry at him. For several years, I think a lot of the focus of what ultimately became my personality, really, but my anger was at religious people, the institutions of religion, God, and this whole thing that I thought had fucked me up. You know, and not to say that it hadn't, it absolutely had. This is not a diatribe about how religious trauma isn't real. Oh my God, go to therapy. But it took a long time for me to, within myself, work through what I felt had been done to me by this particular sect of Christianity, because that is another thing that I try to stress whenever I have these conversations about the religious right, the Christian right, the fundamentals, you know what I mean? is that I don't like to say it's a problem with Christians, because not all Christians are like this. And while I have my personal opinions about organized religion, in the Western conception, particularly white American organized religion, and some of the more conservative black churches as well, to be perfectly honest, there's a tendency towards social regression that I think should be addressed and is kind of a problem. But a lot of those people are going to die, and you hope that their kids are smarter than them. A lot of them aren't, but some of them will be. And it's necessary to recognize that, you know, not all Christians are these people. Christianity is, at its core, is not fundamentally about white nationalism. That this is, like all religions, as we've seen in other places in the world and in other organizations, religion is an easy control system. And so people trying to control people oftentimes use religion to do so because it fucking works. So it's not, you know, don't necessarily hate people who adhere to belief systems or have beliefs, because in many cases, there's a lot of positive things that can be derived from religions, just like there are any other ideology or theory or whatever. There are usually positives that can be derived from it. We can all look at the people who adhere to them and say, did you need that to come to those conclusions? Sure, but who's got the fucking time is kind of my point. We, particularly in the United States, as a culture that has been inundated by the Christian right, something that we're going to talk about again today, have a tendency to throw the Jesus out with the bathwater, if you will, the baby Jesus. I don't necessarily think that there's a benefit in doing that, particularly if you are the kind of person who looks toward, like, leftist organization, like, what is it, something like 2/3 of the planet has some sort of a belief system of some kind. So when you go to war with the idea of belief in, like, an anti-theist sort of a thing, you're working at cross purposes with yourself. And like I said, there's, just as there is any other ideology, there is the potential for control and exploitation. Religion is an effective one because, like I said on the last episode, most of them have some sort of a monopoly on what happens to you forever after you die. And that's an easy way to scare people who are already disenfranchised and poor in most cases. But as many people who are very ardent believers of things tend to be disenfranchised poor people, I don't know that we do ourselves any favors by just wholesale attacking the religious, because in many cases they're just as fucked as the rest of us and they needed a thing. Some of us, rather than the religion thing, do drugs. That's also fine. Some of us have sex. That's also fine. Television, shopping. I don't give a fuck. Everybody has a thing, is kind of my point. And all of them are potentially dangerous, for fuck. As human beings, we have the potential to overexert anything to the point that it becomes unhealthy, dangerous, and anti-human. It's just a matter of understanding where that point is and not doing that, that I think is a problem for so many people. But I don't think that's exclusive to religion. The same thing can be said of politics or any number of other things. So I think that nuance gets pulled out of a lot of conversations because it's counterproductive to success as a media personality, a pundit, an ideologue, whatever it is you happen to be aspiring to not be hard black and white about everything. It either is, yes, we support this and we'll die trying to make it happen, or fuck you, we hope your mother gets cancer. And that is everything, because it's the only way to get people to pay attention to you. But it's also fundamentally dishonest and unethical to treat every argument as something that is particularly black and white. That's usually counterproductive to accomplishing things. And why, as many people have noticed and are upset about, particularly in the United States these days, nothing ever gets the fuck done. So I try to, in my own delivery of topics, when we cover material, whenever we cover subjects, I try not to remove the nuance from the conversation in my assessment of these things, because I think these are important things to be related to people. And it's also important to, while you can say at the end of the day, yeah, fuck that guy, you should actually know why. Because it's important to be principled and honest in your critique, I think. At least a lot of people seem to suggest that's a thing that they want. That might just be because that's an easy identity to co-opt. I don't know. But I think that for what I do and the person that I attempt to be, it's good to recognize that religion can be a very, very bad, very dangerous thing. It's not inherently a very, very bad, very dangerous thing. And there are a lot of people with very strong beliefs in this stuff who dedicate their lives to the servitude of other people, treating other people like human beings, trying to avert the colossal takeover of the Christo-fascist right that some of us are very, very afraid of. I think it's necessary to not lump those people in with, you know, Franco necessarily. So I think that that is something that I wanted to take a few minutes to address before I slam the Christian right for like another hour and 10 minutes or so. Because today, as promised, dear listeners, before we get started, let's do the plug. So if you like what you hear, not the last 10 minutes of me talking about why it's not okay to hate Christians, but if you've listened to the show and you like the show, you can support the ongoing efforts of Come and See and become a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep Cult by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And there's a few different tiers for you there with a few different reward options that'll be available for you, so that if you feel so inclined or you just think I'm cute, you can help me pay my bills and buy food and whatnot, which are, you know, things that I this cat named Maslow said were cool that I wouldn't mind getting in on every now and again. So having said that and gotten the ugliness of capitalism out of the way, today, as promised, we are going to discuss the John Birch Society. And it's taken me a while to get to this one because I had to read some of the things Robert Welch, the founder of the John Birch Society, we'll get to it, wrote. And he's a terrible goddamn writer. Imagine those of you who've had the displeasure of reading, for example, like The Great Reset, the Alex Jones thing, or the Glenn Beck thing, for that matter, because I think both of them actually wrote a book called The Great Reset. I've read both. They were both terrible. But those of you who've read that are perhaps some of the angrier Bill O'Reilly screeds. Picture that in slightly smaller, less double-spaced space type, with a lot more about the Jews and the communists, slightly more than Glenn Beck, not more than Alex Jones. So Bob Welch's writing is very, very difficult to get through because he was a raving goddamn lunatic. And the minutes from the first meeting of the John Birch Society, which is what I believe ended up becoming the Blue Book, they were revised like six times, and every single revision is in the thing. There's literally, it's photocopied with his notes in the margins written into it. It's like reading a church council meeting minutes after somebody's gotten very, very angry about the percentages that are going to the outreach committee for the thing at the park. It's an inside joke for a handful of you. But it's important, I think, to put the John Birch Society within the context of a lot of this other stuff we've talked about. You know, we talked about Christo-fascism on the last episode, and particularly how that's manifested in the United States. And on the pilot season, we talked about a history of American fascism and kind of the American fascist paramilitary movement, and how the Bruderschweigen and several other people factored into that. And one thing every single fucking one of those people has in common is at some point they were members of the John Birch Society. Now, a lot of them very quickly became too radical for the John Birch Society, but it is worth noting that, like, every single right-wing extremist shitbag, whether they were a domestic terrorist or a political analyst, at some point or another in the last 60 years or so, they were part of this group. So today, we're going to talk about who the John Birch Society is, because they kind of got popular again like 5 or 6 years ago, like every other fucking dog shit thing that's ever happened in the history of the world. But who they are, why that's terrifying, and a little bit of a look at some of the tendrils that have sprouted from the John Birch Society. So strap in. It's gonna be scary. But I'll take that joint back too. I'm done talking, so you can pass back the joint now. Thank you. All right, here we go. The John Birch Society is really rooted, along with most of the groups we talked about on the last episode of the show, in an informal collective designation known as the Old Right. The Old Right describes a branch of American conservatism that was most prominent from 1910 to the mid-1950s. The New Right supplanted it in the 60s and 70s, and that was best exemplified by people like Ronald Reagan and William F. Buckley Jr. The Old Right were unified by support for nationalism, anti-Zionism, anti-Masonry, anti-communism, support for rule of law, a general skepticism of democracy, support for limited government, and fear of the federal government. Many of the Old Right were actually former radical leftists who turned abruptly right-wing and embraced a form of laissez-faire classical liberalism. Most of what would be considered the Old Right coalesced around opposition to FDR and the New Deal, first really coming together after a split within the Republican Party in 1910. The Old Right broke with Theodore Roosevelt and the Progressive Movement in 1912. Most of them were Southern Democrats who formed the conservative coalition with many Republicans in 1937. Conservatives on both sides of the aisle opposed the New Deal coalition and labor unions, as well as welfare programs and the expansion of federal power. This conservative coalition was the dominant right-wing political entity from its establishment until 1963 and the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, and it remained on an active presence in Washington until 1994. The Old Right is really defined by isolationism and an aversion to foreign political interaction, mostly due to a fear of a one-world communist government. And in many ways, Bob Welch and the John Birch Society functioned as a bridge from the vestiges of the Old Right into the modern era. Like, Trump has been called a John Birch Society president by many people before. And Alex Jones's dad was a member as well. I think that Alex Jones himself was quoted as saying that Donald Trump was more John Birch Society than the John Birch Society, whatever the fuck that means. Modern paleoconservatism is also a reboot of old right ideologies. For example, America First was an old right slogan, and paleocons tend to emphasize traditionalism and Christian nationalism in addition to the base template of the old right. Even the term paleoconservative is actually a tongue-in-cheek reference to old right. It's fair to say that the beliefs and tactics of the old right through Bob Welch survived through the end of the old right and have returned to just become right-wing politics. Bob Welch was born in 1899, and he was homeschooled until the age of 10 when he enrolled in high school, and he attended the University of North Carolina by age 12. He identified as a fundamentalist Baptist from a very young age, and I'm not going to get into the whole candy thing, because quite frankly, I don't give a fuck, but he had a fairly unremarkable career selling a whole bunch of different kinds of candy in three, I think, different companies, working alternatively, independently, and with one of his brothers named James. He was an ardent anti-communist from his teenage years and a strong proponent of conspiracy theories, such as the idea of a communist New World Order, and that all of the American people consisted of four groups. Communists, communist dupes or sympathizers, the uninformed who have yet to be awakened to the communist danger, and the ignorant. Now, I struggled with that when I read that, because to me, the last two sound like the same group, but I told you, Bob Welch is not a great writer. Welch made enough money in the candy business to help push himself to prominence in Massachusetts politics, serving as director of the Chambers of Commerce in both Boston and Cambridge, and ran, albeit unsuccessfully, for lieutenant governor of Massachusetts in 1950. Welch believed that a communist conspiracy controlled the government, and he opposed Dwight Eisenhower, that Dwight Eisenhower, as a secret communist. That Dwight Eisenhower. Welch was also anti-democratic and believed that if given the choice, people would incorrectly choose socialism. Thus, choice was not in the nation's best interest. I find that fantastic, by the way, because we're going to talk a little bit later about how he structured the John Birch Society based on the teachings of Mao Zedong, and that he had sort of an admiration and obsession for like the Khmer Rouge and like different communist insurgency groups, and kind of fashioned himself as an authoritarian leader within the structure of the John Birch Society, and also was anti-democratic because he believed that if you gave people the option, they would choose socialism. So here's a guy who himself admired communist leaders and a communist revolution and studied it and patterned his organization after it and fashioned himself as the chairman, something that we talked about Roger Ailes doing as well with the establishment of Fox News. Also interesting. And was concerned that if you let people choose, they would choose communism, and that's a bad thing. But he himself was... It's fascinating how these people think, is all I'm saying. Anyway, he supported both the Lesser Taft, Robert A., and Senator Joe McCarthy in their political aspirations, and in 1956, he began publishing a magazine to espouse his ideology called One Man's Opinion, which he later renamed American Opinion, which I think is telling. Welch was a proponent of the campaign to impeach Earl Warren, due primarily to his role in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. And over time, Welch sought to create a political advocacy group for his conspiratorial fringe right-wing views. And like I said, he looked to Mao, of all people, for structural inspiration. This political advocacy group would become the John Birch Society. See, following the death of Stalin in 53, much of the old right's feverish anti-communist propaganda began to lose relevance because the communist big bad was dead and there wasn't really anybody to look at and say, that's the guy now. So it was kind of dying out as a concept as the old right was dying out as a movement, and the new right's focuses had a lot less to do with communism overall. And it may have in fact died out completely as a conservative interest, if not for Joe McCarthy and Bob Welch. The namesake of the John Birch Society is himself the subject of a conspiracy and quite a bit of anti-communist propaganda. John Morrison Birch was a U.S. Air Force military intelligence captain and an OSS agent in China during World War II. Birch was also a Baptist missionary who was moonlighting as a chaplain to military personnel at the time. Now, there's a lot of controversy over how much of an asshole this guy was in real life, because so much propaganda has been written about him since he died. But long story short, I'm going to yada 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 this one a bit, because there's a lot of conflicting stories about what actually happened, and well, I wasn't in China in the 1940s. But John Birch was killed during a what sounds like drunken confrontation with officers of the Chinese Communist Party after allegedly refusing to disarm. As such, Birch is considered by Welch and many others to be a martyr and the first death in America's war against communism. Welch took the name the John Birch Society in 1958 and held a meeting with 12 other men who would form the inaugural John Birch Society. The membership of that first group would have after effects for fucking decades to come. Among them, some of these names are going to sound familiar, Revillo P. Oliver, who we've discussed briefly in the past as the mentor of William Luther Pierce, who would also eventually join the John Birch Society. Oliver was one of the founders of the National Review, actually, and he also worked on Welch's American Opinion. He had served in military intelligence during the Second World War, and many of his academic writings focused on white nationalism and anti-Semitism, because of course they did. Ironically, he worked closely with William F. Buckley, who would go on to publicly oppose the JBS in 1962. The other founders, Lawrence E. Bunker, Louis Rotenberg, William J. Grebe, Robert W. Stoddard, W.B. McMillan, T. Coleman Andrews, someone I recommend you look up, and Fred C. Koch, formed the nucleus of the John Birch Society. And as I said, they modeled the group as a vanguard conspiratorial anti-communist radical political advocacy group made up of small cells of less than 15 to avoid outside infiltration. The group's manifesto, The Blue Book, was officially released in 1961, and by that point, the group alleged membership of over 100,000. Many noteworthy names passed through the membership rolls. I sort of glossed over a pretty fucking big one a few minutes ago in Fred C. Koch. Fred was the father of Charles and David, two of the arguably worst men in the history of the United States of America. He also founded the oil refinery that would become Koch Industries, one of the largest privately owned companies in the country. Koch hated communism and published a 39-page anti-communist pamphlet called A Businessman Looks at Communism in 1929, expressing fear of a communist world takeover. See, he had gone to Soviet Russia, as I understand it, and was so alarmed by what he saw there that he spent the rest of his life trying to scare people into not letting it happen here. He also wrote extensively about the threat of internal communist infiltration within American business and within American politics, and his paranoia and massive goddamn fortune helped keep anti-communism at the forefront of American conservatism for a very, very, very long time. The year that he co-founded the JBS, he also helped push through an amendment to the Constitution of Kansas to make it a right-to-work state. So They all sucked. Another prominent early member of the JBS and an author of much of its early literature was a man that you're familiar with, but you don't realize you are, named W. Cleon Skousen. Skousen worked for the Agricultural Adjustment Administration and then the FBI while attending law school. he left the FBI in 1951, and ironically, by the time of his death in 2006, the FBI's file on Skousen was over 2,000 fucking pages long. He taught at Brigham Young University from 1951 to 1955, and he served as the Salt Lake City Chief of Police in 1956 until 1960. Skousen was dismissed after ordering a raid on an illegal poker game that the mayor was attending. And after his dismissal, Skousen supporters began burning crosses on the mayor's lawn. So there's that. In 1961, Skousen founded the All-American Society, which was an ultra-nationalist conservative magazine that espoused JBS ideologies. He served as a member of the JBS's Speakers Bureau and regularly lectured at their events. Skousen sort of functions as a bridge from the fringe anti-communist right wing into the Mormon LDS, and through him, the John Birch Society was able to throw its weight behind the continued segregation of the Mormon Church in the 1970s. Skousen also served as a member of Tim LaHaye's Council for National Policy. Tim was also a member of the JBS, but we'll get to that later. Skousen and Carol Quigley, who was the author of Tragedy and Hope, built much of the, what you could consider to be academic backbone of the John, not only the John Birch Society, but the modern fringe right, which is now just the right. And he's cited as a primary influence by Glenn Beck, for example, as well as Orrin Hatch, Mitt Romney, Ben Carson, and at this point, Skousen's once fringe allegation that the Democratic Party was a Trojan horse for communism is just what most Republicans think. Skousen's work also heavily influenced the sovereign citizen movement. In keeping with the subject of influential members, Phyllis Schlafly joined the JBS in 1959. Schlafly was a part of the anti-New Deal sect of the old right movement, and she rose to prominence as an anti-feminist, anti-veteran leader against the desegregation of schools, the Equal Rights Amendment, and she, along with Jerry Falwell, helped really manufacture the American Christian right. Schlafly's book, A Choice Not an Echo, helped create the template for modern conservatism, and it also helped secure the presidential nomination of Barry Goldwater, who would bring JBS ideology to a mainstream stage. Schlafly's affiliation with the JBS was largely kept a secret for fear that it would damage her reputation at a mainstream level. Her influence really can't be overstated, and she'll have her own episode of the show eventually, I promise. She effectively killed the Equal Rights Amendment by transforming it into a war on gender roles. The John Birch Society was at the forefront of cultivating a right-wing media space as well, and they threw support behind conservative radio broadcaster Clarence Mannion and his show Mannion Forum in the 50s and 60s. The JBS's work in the 60s focused heavily on circulating propaganda suggesting that the civil rights movement was secretly a front for communist infiltration. We've talked a little bit about this in the past. Due to membership from Revillo Oliver and his protege Bill Pierce, the JBS was closely allied with the segregationist Governor George Wallace. By 1961, Welch and the Birchers held the belief that the United States was 40 to 60% controlled by secret communists, and their support base responded very well to this idea. By 1966, you know what, hang on a second. This is a thing that confuses me, because they're not the only people who say shit like this. You can hear Alex Jones say shit like this, that there is a 60% global takeover already in the process. And I don't understand how you can tell people that more than half of the governing body of the United States is communist, but we should start worrying about a communist takeover. I think if you get to the point where, like Bob Welch was, that Dwight Eisenhower is a secret communist infiltrator, then who beyond the president do you worry about exactly? I don't, that's a thing, you know, I'm going to divert for half a second and talk about, okay. Right after 9/11, I flew internationally. I went to Germany for a couple of weeks. And on the flight back, the security was as such as I'd never seen before. Guys with automatic rifles and dogs and whatnot, probably like 9 different security checkpoints. And there was one at the gate. And at the gate, they searched all of the flight attendants and the pilot and the co-pilot. And that was 21 years ago, and to this day, I don't understand the benefit of searching the guy flying the plane to make sure he doesn't try to hijack the guy flying the plane. And in the same way, if you're concerned that communism is going to overthrow the American government, and your jumping off point is, by the way, the president is a communist, hasn't communism already taken over the country at that point? I call me crazy. It just seems cross purposes to say that we need to look out for secret communists. And by the way, all of you are secret communists. Also, it's not like Dwight Eisenhower was some radical goddamn leftist in his political approach. I mean, fuck, look at his records. So if your concern is that guy was the result of a radical, secret, clandestine communist overthrow of the United States government, and he's still just kind of a right-wing Republican, I don't really see what the issue is as far as you're concerned, but I don't know, I also couldn't give a shit. So there is that. Anyway, the 40 to 60% thing, we were just talking about that. By 1966, the JBS carried an annual budget of $6 million. Based on his studies and interpretations on the work of Mao Zedong, who Welch sort of admired semi-openly, again, and some of the tactics were remarkably effective. For example, entire families were invited to join the JBS, and children were instructed to inform their parents if any teachers at school were espousing anything that sounded like communist ideology, so that the school board could then be mobilized to pressure the school into removing that teacher. They organized telephone campaigns, pamphlet canvassing, and distributed literature to millions of Americans, proclaiming Welch's insane conspiratorial bullshit. Among those ideas was the fear of the Soviet Negro Republic. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, so we're going to talk about it for a second. The idea of the Soviet Negro Republic was actually first proposed in the 30s. By black communists who were influenced by Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement. Allegedly, the idea was supported by Stalin and Leninists in the Soviet Union, who opposed the U.S.'s Jim Crow legislation. In The Negroes in a Soviet America, which was a 1935 book written by James W. Ford and James Allen, a Soviet-style self-determined black republic within the United States is theorized, with support from Stalin as an independent black state. In 1945, leader of the CPUSA, Earl Browder, testified that the official American Communist Party did not and had never supported the idea and had no plans to attempt to implement it. Ever. Nonetheless, the JBS revived the idea nearly 20 years later as an anti-civil rights propaganda campaign, suggesting that the secret agenda of the civil rights movement was the establishment of an all-black communist state in the United States with Martin Luther King as the president. Propaganda promoting the claim was distributed by the society at events held for the presidential campaign of Barry Goldwater. Pushback within the conservative movement against the JBS began in 1962, coming first from former ally William F. Buckley Jr. and his magazine, The National Review. Buckley expressed a fear that Welch, the Birchers, and their ideas presented a form of conservatism that made the whole movement look crazy and dangerous. The Birchers continued distributing literature by Welch and Skousen, and in the mid-1960s, Welch began to collaborate with Dan Smoot, a former FBI agent who wrote The Invisible Government in 1962, which was one of the earliest conspiratorial works concerning the Council on Foreign Relations. Welch wrote voraciously. In fact, he'd penned The Road to Salesmanship, May God Forgive Us, The Politician, and The Life of John Birch all before the Society even officially began. One of the JBS's first public campaigns took place in 1959, the Get Us Out campaign. It claimed that the U.S. needed to leave the U.N. because a United Nations is a precursor to a one-world government. Sound familiar? They also orchestrated the first War on Christmas public outcry campaign, claiming that a subversive communist movement sought to eliminate Christmas in an attack on American traditionalism. Sound familiar? In 1960, Welch advised JBS members to join their local PTAs and take them over. That's a quote. According to Political Research Associates, the John Birch Society revolutionized and pioneered grassroots lobbying, combining educational meetings, petition drives, and letter-writing campaigns. Welch continued his wild conspiratorial accusations in the 60s, alleging that the U.S.'s involvement in the Vietnam War was somehow a secret communist plot. I don't know how you could rationalize that the United States' fear that a country that was geographically too close to us being communist was a threat to business as a secret plot by communism, but whatever, it's clear the man wasn't all there. In addition to the idea that we were in Vietnam because we were communist, he also opposed water fluoridation as a secret communist mass medicine plot to destroy and sterilize American children. While large, and with a membership that spans from the Bruderschweigen to the Christian Coalition, the JBS doesn't, as an entity, work with other organizations, except for one very obvious exception. Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority. We'll get to it. From the mid to late 60s, Birchers opposed sex education and were the focus of a free speech debate when Welch was sued for libel for accusing a lawyer of being part of a secret plot to merge all American police departments into one national police force. The case made it to the Supreme Court, who held that Welch was responsible for damages in issues without proof of malice against private citizens. So there you have a case of libel where a right-wing conspiratorial conservative ideologue was involved in a shooting victim conspiracy that he tried to turn into a free speech issue based on intent of malice against a private citizen. Sandy Hook, like 60 years before Sandy Hook. Despite attempts to stymie the Birchers' political influence, their proximity to Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign brought the group into the mainstream. Goldwater did lose the election, but his campaign is considered to be something of a rally point in the conservative movement, cited as an inspiring the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s. Goldwater was a representative of the anti-New Deal old right, sorry about that, and he was also surprisingly liberal for a conservative, and by today's standards, Fox News would have called him a communist. Overton's window is wild. He was also Jewish and was the first person of Jewish descent nominated for president by a major party. He also supported the civil rights movement and legal weed and socialized medicine as a conservative in the 1970s, or 1960s. So that's weird. Following Goldwater's unsuccessful run for office, the John Birch Society shifted its focus to opposing the Equal Rights Amendment. First actually proposed and introduced to Congress in 1923, the ERA was designed to guarantee equal legal rights to all American citizens regardless of sex, effectively ending legal distinctions between men and women in matters like employment and divorce. The ERA had been set to pass by its ratification deadline of March 22, 1979, until Phyllis Schlafly brought to bear the conservative women's movement to oppose it on the grounds that equality disadvantaged housewives, and it would make women susceptible to a military draft and vulnerable to a loss of alimony in divorce proceedings. Schlafly framed the ERA as an attack on women and traditional gender roles, rather successfully, in fact. Using grassroots tactics, Schlafly and the JBS pushed the idea that the ERA would eliminate gender-specific bathrooms and pave the way for same-sex marriage. Two ideas the conservative movement would never use for fear-mongering propaganda ever the fuck again. Anyway, Schlafly was, as I said before, an anti-feminist firebrand, and the conservative movement absolutely loved her for it. Her speech to the 1980 Republican National Convention opened with, quote, "I'd like to thank my husband for letting me be here tonight. I like to say that because it makes the libs so mad." Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Her push against the ERA took it from widespread support to widespread condemnation. It's widely believed that without Schlafly, the ERA would have been ratified by 1976. Instead, the ERA sits largely unimplemented to this day, although the Me Too movement did bring interest in it back to the public forum in 2018. Schlafly's efforts were bolstered in many states by the JBS. Schlafly's affiliation wasn't stressed to the public, but her agenda and tactics were squarely in line with those of the society. They helped push propaganda for her Stop ERA movement. And she came into conflict directly with Gloria Steinem over this, in opposition to the amendment, and earned herself the somewhat pejorative nickname, Mrs. America. Joining the fight against the ERA was the LDS, through W. Cleon Skousen's conservative Mormon sect, Southern whites, Roman Catholics, and anti-abortion rights groups. Ratification of the ERA ultimately passed the deadline, but the fight for the amendments does still continue. Schlafly herself was rather instrumental in the conservative right wing for years to come, and she died just after having endorsed Donald Trump for president. Just one last gift on the way out, I guess. As mainstream popularity for the JBS began to wane, one of its members, Tim LaHaye, would ensure the survival of JBS principles for decades to come. First, an associate of LaHaye's, Paul Weyrich, who has been described as the Vladimir Lenin of social conservatism, was an influential member of the New Right, and a former aide of Joseph Kors, who convinced Kors to fund the creation of the Heritage Foundation in 1973. The foundation was conceived as a think tank to combat liberal and anti-business regulation. Weyrich and Edwin Fulner worked with Laszlo Pastor, a Hungarian neo-Nazi and a former member of the Arrow Cross Party, which had collaborated with Hitler during the war, to run the Heritage Foundation. Weyrich helped put Pastor in the position of head of ethnic outreach for the RNC. Former Nazi, head of ethnic outreach. The irony just never stops. After the establishment of the Heritage Foundation, with the aid of LaHaye and the JBS, in 1979, Weyrich and Jerry Falwell would found the Moral Majority. The predecessor to the Moral Majority, the Christian Voice, rose to popularity with the New Right. They actually issued report cards to businesses and politicians, grading their adherence to conservative values. The Christian Voice helped organize grassroots Christian political action through the implementation of what they called a church networking guide. The Christian Voice was started as a coalition of anti-gay and anti-pornography organizations and was funded in part by Pat Robertson, who later helped the Christian Coalition form as well. Weyrich used the resources of the Heritage Foundation to staff the Christian Voice with mavericks in the burgeoning field of right-wing Christian political activism. Names some of you may recognize, like Richard Viguerie, Howard Phillips, who ensured the Christian Voice would be at the forefront of the Christian right. Unfortunately, the organization faded from popularity quickly because there were too many Catholics and Jews involved. That soured Christian right leadership. In order to rectify this, televangelist Jerry Falwell was approached. The other thing that probably didn't help the Christian Voice was that they received a lot of financial support from the Moonies, which is kind of a death knell for groups. And in 1979, they were officially supplanted by the Moral Majority. The Moral Majority really helped marry the concept of family values to the Christian right. Falwell's championing of what is known as familialism fit really nicely next to conservative pushes for smaller, limited government. Interestingly enough, if you look at statistics, America has never really functioned as a bastion for traditional families. Less than 60% of families in the U.S. are considered traditional, with the whole two-parent thing. But suggesting that this is a new, rectifiable phenomenon proved immeasurably popular here. Falwell founded Liberty University in 1971, and by the foundation of the Moral Majority, he had become a prominent figure within the Christian right. Weyrich actually coined the name Moral Majority himself, and the group would go on in the 80s to be the most influential conservative political action organization in the country. Bob Welch would step down as chairman of the JBS in 1983, putting Larry McDonald in charge moving forward. Larry McDonald held the second most conservative congressional voting record in history, and he championed the ideas of the old right as Georgia's congressional representative from 1937 until the mid-1970s. And he was a close ally of Ron Paul, the only congressman in history recognized as having a more conservative voting record than McDonald. The man kept a portrait of Francisco Franco in his fucking office, if that tells you anything. Fortunately, McDonald was killed in a plane crash over Russia, while embroiled in a lawsuit over attempts to blackmail members of the Reagan administration. Interesting. The Moral Majority was a nationwide political conservative phenomenon, really. While the JBS was decried as radical and conspiratorial, its members could move freely within the Moral Majority. Falwell was able to grow support and influence quickly, pulling from the mailing lists collected from involved Christian right organizations and individuals. At height of powers, the Moral Majority boasted 4 million members and 2 million donors. The popularity of the Moral Majority declined by the end of the Reagan administration, and the group disbanded in 1989. As it turns out, 8 years of moral Christian leadership kind of burned everybody out on the concept. Bob Welch died in 1985, and the JBS sort of fell out of fashion for a time, but it didn't disband. By the 1990s and the advent of the Patriot Militia movement, the JBS was suddenly a lot less extreme. Granted, many notable domestic terrorists were members, but the JBS itself was tame compared to the growing sovereign citizen and Christian identity movements. During this time period, the JBS came to be more closely identified with libertarianism and something called business nationalism. Business nationalism is an offshoot of the old right and the Red Scare that espouses Jewish banking conspiracies and champions union busting. It really came to prominence and emerged in the 30s as part of a belief that the New Deal was proof of a sinister alliance between international financiers and communist-controlled labor unions who were conspiring to destroy free enterprise. Originally, the movement was championed by Gerald L. K. Smith, and his support for the idea garnered him financial support from businessmen in nationalist-oriented businessmen. Some of those names include Quaker State, Pennzoil, Henry Ford, John F. Dodge, and J. Howard Pugh, who was also a member of the John Birch Society. I think that this bears mentioning because here we see private business interests providing donations to a Christo-fascist because his broader agenda marginally benefited theirs. In this, we really see that business and fascism are more likely friends than enemies. After all, fascists still buy cars. The influence of business nationalism and the legacy of Fred Koch made sure that the JBS never fell on hard times financially, and through the Koch brothers, Fred's sons, well, two of them anyway, the ideology and tactics of the JBS would be utilized with sweeping success by the Tea Party. The JBS also helped mainstream the long fringe anti-tax movement, helping campaign to lower the federal income tax rate. They opposed Earth Day, MLK Day, sex education, gay marriage, abortion, promoted the Chinese genocide conspiracy, and campaigned against the ratification of the UN's Genocide Convention. After Welch's death, the JBS worked more in concert with other conservative groups, such as Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum, and over time, their brand of conservatism has just become conservatism. In 2010, for example, the JBS sponsored CPAC, which sort of signaled the mainstream conservative acceptance of a longtime pariah. It's been said by Roger Stone, so grain of salt, that Fred Trump was a member and financial backer of the JBS, and it's also been said that Trumpism is just Bircherism. Trump's former chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, actually spoke at the JBS's National Council dinner right before joining the administration. The current right-wing media sphere is likewise a continuation of the JBS's media network. What started with the Mannion Forum grew to over 500 weekly broadcasts, and now right-wing media is the dominant news media on network television. As the New Deal and school desegregation once coalesced the Birchers around the idea that Earl Warren was a secret communist, the Tea Party, astroturfed by the Kochs, who were, again, members of the John Birch Society and sons of a lifelong member of the John Birch Society, swore to irrefutable, incontestable proof that Barack Obama was a secret socialist born in another country. The demonization of Black Lives Matter, the fight against hate crime legislation, the grassroots social media campaigns, the JBS's template really lives on in the modern right wing. Trump himself bears striking resemblance in his political approach to Bob Welch, leaning on conspiracy and xenophobia to cultivate his fan base. And we've discussed that the Tea Party, in large part, just became MAGA. In this way, despite personal animosity between Trump and the Kochs, Trump really is a John Birch president. The group's current CEO, Arthur Thompson, has acknowledged as much, saying that Trump captured a movement built on the political causes championed by the John Birch Society for decades, and that's hard to argue with. The JBS, in modern times, supported both the 2020 election fraud conspiracy and the subsequent January 6th riot, tweeting out on January 7th, quote, "Don't give up, it's always darkest before the dawn, we can fix this, get involved," end quote. In the following months, their online presence shifted largely to discussing about the potential inevitability of a second civil war. And probably my favorite, ironically, the group that spent its entire existence promoting the idea that Russia interfered in U.S. elections spearheaded social media campaigns denying allegations that Russia interfered in the 2016 election. So what started out is just a fringe far right-wing organization that the broader conservative movement wanted nothing to do with out of fear that conspiratorial, obviously bullshit allegations made against well-established mainstream political figures would blow back and make the conservative movement look bad. 60, 70 years later, that's just what conservative politics are. And you can't really say for sure whether Bob Welch knew that this was going to be the evolution of politics, but his involvement sure as fuck didn't hurt. So here we are in the era of post-Trump, looking at a political landscape that includes people like Ron DeSantis, Kanye West, Donald Trump, and a host of other quasi-fascist, Christian nationalist, white supremacist lunatics. And after looking at people like Bob Welch and David Duke and some of the progenitors of what turned into modern conservatism, you have to wonder where all of the logical conservatives went, or if there ever were any to begin with, because it seems to be all that's left is the lunatics that we heard for years needed to not have a platform because giving them a platform would be dangerous. And now they have a platform and it is in fact dangerous. And all of the people who said that we needed to not let them run the party are just kind of like letting them. It's an interesting development. And in that, I think that it's important to make note of some of the names involved in this shit as well. I do very briefly want to go over some of the names on this list because they are frightening. Probably least frightening, maybe most surprising, maybe not. John fucking Wayne was a member of the John Birch Society for like 65 years. I didn't know that until I started doing research for this episode, but it's another reason to hate John Wayne, and you can never have too many of those. George Wallace, another recurring villain on Come and See, was a leader of the John Birch Society at one point. H.L. Hunt, William Luther Pierce, Thomas Robb, Tom Metzger, all of the members of the Order, David Lane, all of those cats, all members of the John Birch Society at various points. And of course, both Koch brothers and the Koch father. Some of the worst people in the history of the United States of America. And like I said, this is an organization that's still active on social media and still putting out a newsletter like every month. And because they are an active political organization, their contact information is researchable online. So if for whatever reason you would like to contact the John Birch Society, perhaps you'd like to give them a report card, you can do so. The address is 770 Northwest Hill Boulevard, Appleton, Wisconsin, 54914. The business phone number is 1-800-JBS-USA-1. The local phone number is 920-749-3780. And you can find them on Twitter at the JBS. They have a blog that I'm not going to give you a link to, but if for some reason you would like to send them some mail or maybe give them a phone call, let them know how they're doing, you can do so there. So that's what I've got for you today on the John Birch Society. In many ways, the JBS, doing research on the JBS was a lot like whenever I did research on the Weathermen Underground in the first season, and that there are so many people involved and it goes off in so many tendrils. You could really spend days covering all of the various aspects of the people who were involved in the John Birch Society, and I feel like I will, but not all at one time, because, you know, content. But... That's a sort of an overview about Bob Welch and the John Birch Society. We didn't really go too deep into the fact that he thought that Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan were secret communists, other than, you know, because it's fucking hilarious to think that anybody believes that the guy who bombed Japan to scare Russia was a secret communist, or that Ronald Reagan could be a secret communist, but there you have it. And like I said, it's interesting because that sort of batshit conspiratorial thinking is just how the Republican Party wins elections now. Because after 60 or 70 years of that existing on the fringe, it's drifted from the fringe into the mainstream. And it's also just worth noting that this, unlike some of the other organizations and people that we've discussed, the JBS never really disappeared. I mean, they still have an active website. They still put out their newsletter. They still have podcasts affiliated with their show. There's still people. I mean, again, Alex Jones name drops the JBS every once in a blue moon, just reminding you that business nationalism and the political ideologies of the old right are really what drives his show. And I think it was also good to get into W. Cleon Skousen, because he's kind of an influential figure that you don't hear people bring up that often. We may do like a whole episode on him at some point, actually. His writing is fascinating in its psychosis. But for now, I think we're going to call it a day. But we will be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. I'm going to take Wednesday off this week since I just did like 3 episodes in 4 days. But I think I'll probably do Friday, and we might actually come back with a bonus episode on Saturday or Sunday to try to get in some of the things that I want to cover as the end of the year drifts ever closer. And originally, I think I was planning on being done by December, but I think we're just going to keep, well, we're just going to do it live. Fuck it. We'll keep on going. I still want to do the Santa Claus, the Black Peter, and the Jesus episode for either the week of Christmas or the week of Christmas Eve. So that's coming at you. And I've still got, I think, 15 or 20 episodes on the episode list that I haven't gotten to yet. So this could keep going through the end of the year. I haven't really decided when I'm going to call it for season 3 to take like a month off and do some clerical stuff. The Blackforge coffee pre-orders are going to be coming at you pretty soon. We're developing the artwork for the bags as we speak. So, I was hoping to have those done in time for Christmas. I don't know if that's going to be the case, but they will be done soon. And, hopefully I'll be able to get you, with a cup of come and see coffee in your hand, enervating yourself so that you can be as agitated as I am every morning. But in the meantime, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See. And I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
Finished.